Welcome to a special Labor Day edition of the Noon Report. This summer, we've donned a mask and traveled to several places as COVID restrictions decreased. The staycation destinations are fairly close to home and won't break the bank. Come along as we revisit a few of those locations in New York and Pennsylvania. First, we journey to the Onondaga Historical Museum in Syracuse, New York. Curator of history Robert Searing rewinds time as we reflect on Central New York's role on the Underground Railroad. Bob, you have called Central New York the great central depot of the Underground Railroad. Would you, first of all, briefly explain what the Underground Railroad was, especially for our younger listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. The Underground Railroad was really underground in the sense that it was a secret system that moved slaves that had run away from bondage in the South through northern locales, ultimately getting them to freedom in Canada. It operated on a sort of, you had to know someone in each community, depending on how fervent the support for abolition was, or the Underground Railroad, had a series of stations and station masters. So essentially, the idea that it was a railroad really comes after the fact. Some folks actually are under the impression that there was a railroad. There was not. It was just a way
to be
that you would jump on the train. But no, it was a series of stations and station masters. And it's a really romantic topic in the sense that there's a lot of things that aren't known. There's a lot of mythology around it, but we do know that it was a very real network of like-minded abolitionists and people that were fighting the injustice of slavery and trying to get people out of bondage and again, to their freedom in Canada.
And Syracuse and that area played a big part.
It was a huge part. Central New York, because of the canal, and Syracuse is known as the Central City. We're almost geographically in the middle of New York State. Because Syracuse was at the center, really, of a transportation network that included the railroads, that included the Erie Canal, the Oswego Canal, it was a short ride up the canal to Lake Ontario, and from there, a ride on to Canada. So here in Syracuse, a particularly important figure, the Reverend Jermaine Wesley Logan, who himself was an escaped slave, was known during his day by contemporaries, including his very good friend Frederick Douglass, as the Underground Railroad King. It's believed that Reverend Logan and his wife Caroline helped shepherd upwards of 1,500 runaway slaves to freedom in Canada. And Reverend Logan was a major figure in Syracuse and one that was rather brazen in his advertisements in the newspaper. It was a place where people knew to come and they looked for Reverend Logan, and Reverend Logan would very often get them up into Canada.
Wow. This is a fascinating part of history. How did songs like Follow the Drinking Gourd play a role in a slave's journey to freedom in the 1800s, Bob?
Well, we know that it certainly was sung, and there are breakdowns as to what the lyrics meant, essentially coded lyrics. But the drinking gourd was a reference to the Big Dipper. And those of us that are interested in astronomy are aware that the Big Dipper contains Polaris, the North Star. And if you are able to trace through the Big Dipper and you can find the North Star, you can walk directionally north. So that was a way by which, again, that sort of coded language of runaways to follow the drinking gourd, the old man come to carry you to freedom. That language certainly was something that would have been passed along, particularly in the border states. It was very difficult for slaves to get out of the deep cotton South, but slaves on the border in Maryland, Delaware, and Kentucky, it was much easier for them to get out and follow the drinking gourd on their way here to the North.
Are many of the buildings that were used as stopovers or stations, as you called them, en route to the North still standing in Central New York and available to be seen today?
Well, there are a few. Unfortunately, not as many as we would like. Here in Syracuse, one of the great stops that you can make is called the Mission Restaurant, and it's actually an old Wesleyan Methodist church that was built in the early 1840s, right here in downtown. It's actually right down the street from our museum. It was absolutely a stop on the Underground Railroad. We know that it had sort of a false basement, so that is still standing. Unfortunately, the home of Jermaine Logan was torn down in the middle of the 20th century, so we've lost that, as we have a lot of other homes. The other issue, obviously, with that is, as things were very secretive, it's difficult to know exactly whose house was where. But Peterborough, Garrett Smith's estate, just outside of Utica, is another spot that I would highly recommend if you're interested in this. Peterborough was really a refuge for a lot of slaves on their way to freedom in the North as well. So, yeah, there are a lot of hot spots. And the Finger Lakes, I know, is also sort of filled, depending on the county, with a couple different places that you can visit. But, yeah, here in Central New York, there are still a few places where you can go see where those slaves were held while they were trying to get to freedom in Canada.
Thank you, Bob. Freedom Bound is actually among the permanent exhibits at the Onondaga Historical Museum in downtown Syracuse. Will you tell us something unique that we could see among that collection in the Salt City?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have two things that I think are really amazing to see. So here in Syracuse in October of 1851 was one of the great events in the lead up to the abolition of slavery known as the Jerry Rescue, when a group of Syracuse citizens, white, black, came together to break William Jerry out of bondage. He had been arrested by a slave catcher to be taken back under the auspices of the Fugitive Slave Act. Reverend Samuel May, Reverend Samuel Logan, and the Vigilance Committee that was here in the city literally went to the jail and broke him out and got him to freedom. And he ultimately made it all the way to Kingston. We actually here in the museum have the shackles that were on Jerry as he awaited trial that morning. So they are on display, an incredibly powerful reminder of the struggles and slavery itself and the fear that many black Americans had to live with in the North while slave catchers were running around trying to get them. One of the other really amazing things we have, I had mentioned the Wesleyan Church in downtown Syracuse. In one of the basements in the church, there were found several faces sort of carved into the earthen walls down there in the basement. And we speculate, based on some archaeological evidence, that they were there at least in the 1870s. So some speculate that they may have been, in fact, been made by slaves awaiting transportation out of the city. And we have several of those on display in our Underground Railroad exhibit, Freedom Bound. So two really incredible pieces that you can see here at our museum in downtown Syracuse.
Bob, what is the cost for visitors to explore the Onondaga Historical Museum?
We are actually free and open to the public. We do, if you're able, recommend a donation if possible, but there is no admission fee. We've been free and open to the public since the museum has been around since the 1980s. We're very proud of that. We also have a phenomenal gift shop here, a gift gallery with some wonderfully unique, really one-of-a-kind pieces. We have an amazing bookstore here. We've got some jewelry made out of typewriters. Syracuse is once a typewriter city. Syracuse, China, things that people would be familiar with. But there is no price of admission, so it really is something that you can do rather cheaply.
So what are the hours and times people can come and explore?
The museum is open Wednesday through Sunday from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock. We're closed on Monday and Tuesday. Those are our regular hours.
Great, Bob. And how else might visitors be surprised as they roam the displays at OHM?
Well, we've just got a really wide variety that harkens back to Syracuse's industrial past. We've got a really wonderful Native American section that highlights some of the history of the Haudenosaunee and the Onondaga Nation, which, of course, call this part of the state home. One of my favorite pieces, we actually have Libba Cotton, the famous blues songwriter and guitar player. We have her Martin and her Grammy Award on display. Right now on the second floor, we have an amazing clothing exhibit out, some beautiful Victorian gowns going all the way back to the 1840s. And we have an American Arts and Crafts exhibit up with lots of pieces made by Gustav Stickley himself on display so people can come see, again, another way in which Central New York touched the entire world.
That's Robert Searing with the Onondaga Historical Museum in Syracuse, New York. Next, we head south to eastern Pennsylvania and the town known as Jim Thorpe. It's nestled between Wilkes-Barre and Allentown. Chris Barrett with the Pocono Mountains Visitors Bureau tells about Jim Thorpe's mining history and the link to athlete Jim Thorpe. It's a quaint place. Would you tell us, first of all, a little bit about the history?
Sure. Jim Thorpe originally was a coal and mining town, predominantly in the 1700s and 1800s, and that's really how it got its predominance to where it is right now. It's set along the Lehigh River in a valley, and the architecture in the town is beautiful, and it's pretty much as you would have seen it in the 1800s with a few exceptions. And in fact, there was a movie filmed there in 1968, The Molly Maguires, which was set in that period, and they filmed it there because the town is pretty much exactly the same as what it was at that time.
Starring Sean Connery.
Starring Sean Connery, yes. Yeah. So it was really a thrill for everybody here in the region to have that big production come to our area.
We're not endorsing that movie necessarily, but no. That movie helped portray people kind of taking the law into their own hands before there were work unions.
Right. So at that time, a lot of European immigrants were coming into the East Coast, laboring and mining operations, among other industrial pursuits, and they took some of those organizations with them. And some of them were, unfortunately, trying to overthrow management of some of those mining operations by some violent means because people didn't unionize at the time. There just wasn't any of that type of representation for labor.
Wow. It sheds light on some of our history. But would you tell us about the athlete, Jim Thorpe?
Sure. So it's interesting how Jim Thorpe got its name. The original name of the town was Mount Chunk. So there were two boroughs in Pennsylvania. One was East Mount Chunk, I believe, and the other was just Mount Chunk. That was the original name of the town. in the 1912 Olympics, Jim Thorpe won multiple gold medals. So he could play any sport, basketball, football, baseball, you name it, and he excelled in all of them. Well, unfortunately, he died in the 50s almost penniless. So his family was trying to find a way to A, memorialize him, and B, try to find a way to pay for his funeral expenses. So Mount Chunk volunteered to be the burying place of Jim Thorpe, and they changed the name of the town from Mount Chunk to Jim Thorpe. The leaders of the town at the time had foresight to know that the mining industry and other industries were declining, so they had to develop something else. And they were trying to develop a tourism economy at the time, and that's how it all started.
And is there a statue of Jim Thorpe there in the town?
Yeah, so there's a memorial of Jim Thorpe a little outside of the town. It's actually in the old East Mount Chunk. But actually, his grandson works for the Pocono Mountains Visitors Bureau. We have a visitor center in the center of town, and he works there a few hours a week. And folks will come in, and he can tell them stories about his grandfather.
Wow,
it's really neat. Yeah, he's
wonderful.
A good guy, too.
So there are other things to explore there as well. We learned earlier this year that the Lehigh Gorge Scenic Railway is back open and running.
Right. That is a significant attraction in the town. And there's an excursion, and it goes through some of the countryside around Jim Thorpe, and you can see some other towns. But it's a bike train as well, so you can actually place your bike on the train, go to the first destination and ride your bike back and vice versa. And I grew up living not too far from Jim Thorpe. There were still some steam trains in town in the late 60s to early 70s. It was amazing to see them come through the town, either by freight or still with passengers at the time. Wow. So the station is still there.
Super. You can kind of go back in time. And you mentioned architecture.
Yes.
We can see a standout of Italian architecture. The Asa Packer Mansion Museum is also a top spot to see.
Right. In fact, there's actually two. Asa and Harry Packer was a father and a son, and they were very involved in the mining and navigation operations. One of the mansions was actually given to the town. The town couldn't operate it, so it remained closed for many, many years. In the 50s and 60s, it was given to a civic club to operate it, so they reopened it. And when they opened it, everything was pretty much as it remained in the early 1900s. Hmm. But the amazing part was the steam trains, locomotives, they emitted through their smoke a carbon-type substance that permeated the building, and over time, you're talking over decades, kind of created a covering over everything, which actually preserved it. And
wow.
It was slightly carbon and oil-based. So when you go into those mansions, especially Harry Packer's mansion, it's a walk back in time. Now, for that, because of COVID, you do have to call ahead of time because they've been closed. The other Packer mansion is open. It's actually a bed and breakfast, beautiful rooms. And also there's an overlook, but those two mansions are definitely a walk back in time. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I've enjoyed the pictures that I have seen. And people can also visit the old jail museum.
Yeah, so the old jail is very, very interesting. Unfortunately, the Molly Maguires, some of them were convicted of crimes. Some of them were hanged in that jail, so the scaffold is still there. But it operated until the 50s. And one of the Molly Maguires touched one of the walls and said that he was innocent, and his handprint remained there on the wall. And apparently multiple owners have tried to remove the handprint, and it's always come back. But the old jail, it's something that you don't normally see. So it's one of the must visits if you're going to Jim Thorpe.
Great. Chris, tell us one more time where people can go for more information before they head to Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania.
Sure. You can visit us at PoconoMountains.com. And we have a number of different planning tools. The site is mobile optimized, which means that if you come into town, you can actually view it on your mobile device. And also, we have a visitor center right in the center of town.
Thanks for coming along to the rolling hills of eastern Pennsylvania to visit the historic Victorian town of Jim Thorpe. I'm Family Life's Tracy Lynn, taking you to destinations in our listening area, places available for you to explore even in this COVID era. So grab your map or GPS device and a mask as we trek northwest to the wilds of Letchworth State Park, about 50 miles south of Rochester. Environmental educator Elijah Kruger unpacks the park's history along with a list of activities and critters you could see on your visit. Elijah, Letchworth State Park is a destination that offers plenty of commanding views. Would you briefly tell us about the types of trails that Letchworth offers to visitors?
By far the most popular trail in the park is the Gorge Trail. It'll be trail number one on a park map. The Gorge Trail offers wonderful views of the gorge. It walks you by all three of the major waterfalls in the park. Anyone that's just got a little bit of time to spend in the park, that's always where we send them to get the best experience in a short amount of time. But we've got 70 miles or more of trail total in the park.
What other sorts of activities can guests join in at Letchworth State Park?
We really are a four-season park. In spring and summer, folks can bring a kayak and go down the Genesee River themselves or do some whitewater rafting. There's fishing available. Even in the wintertime, there's plenty to do. We've got an extensive cross-country ski and snowshoe trail system, and we also allow snowmobiling.
And is there a pool as well?
Yep, there's an Olympic-sized swimming pool. It's got a designated diving well at the north end of the park, which is by the Mount Morris entrance.
There are several entrance ways to the park. Would you tell us something distinct about the main ones?
Yeah, there are five entrances total into Letchworth State Park. The Castile and Portageville entrances would both get you into the sort of southwest corner, what we refer to as the heart of the park. And either entrance gives you quick access to the Humphrey Nature Center, the Glen Iris Inn, the William Pryor Letchworth Museum, the Gorge Trail, and all three of the big waterfalls in the park.
And that's the area where the park really started because it was originally a private home.
Yes, William Pryor Letchworth donated his land in the early 1900s. Originally, it was his 1,000-acre estate that he donated to the state of New York to be kept as public parkland. And that 1,000 acres included the three major waterfalls, what we call Upper Falls, Middle Falls, and Lower Falls.
Elijah, I know there's some structures there that were built by members of the Civilian Conservation Corps back in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, there were actually a total of four Civilian Conservation Corps, or CCC, camps here in the park. They were doing work here in the park between 1933 and 1941, and they were responsible for building a lot of the picnic shelters. There are some really neat stone-top picnic tables, lots and lots of stone walls, and the cabins they built here in the park for us, as well as the Lower Falls Footbridge Trail, which spans the Genesee River. There are some camp remnants still available. What's kind of interesting, of course, the CCC program ended essentially when the U.S. entered World War II. So one of the CCC camps here in Letchworth, the Lower Falls camp, was actually converted to a German prisoner of war camp. And when you go down and visit the area, there's an interpretive sign that tells you all about that kind of history, and actually laid out in the field are lettered blocks where you can kind of map together for yourself how that camp would have been laid out.
Wow, I had no idea. Thank you for uncovering that for us. Elijah, Letchworth has been called the Grand Canyon of the East and was recently named this year's top state park in America. Letchworth actually was given a 10 out of 10 for wildlife. What kind of animals can be seen regularly in the woods of Letchworth?
Each spring and summer, we can have at least 120 or so different kinds of birds that may be nesting in the park. Bald eagle sightings are not uncommon. In the woods, we've got lots of deer. There are red fox. There's the occasional black bear sighting by some of our visitors. But we also have put out some trail cameras into some of the deeper woods in the park where visitors typically don't explore out to. And we've captured some really neat photos and videos of some of the less commonly seen animals in the woods, like bobcat and coyote and fisher, which is an elusive member of the weasel family.
Yeah, and some of those are nicer to watch on video than up close and personal. Is there a cost to get into the park in general?
During our busy season, typically spring through autumn, there is a $10 entrance fee. That's actually per vehicle. So a whole family in the minivan, it's only $10 for the vehicle.
That's Elijah Kruger with Letchworth State Park in western New York. Now we set out to take in a few more sights of nature, but these are the more manicured kind. Crossing into the Keystone State, we next stop in State College, Pennsylvania. You may not get to see a football game right now at Beaver Stadium, but guests are able to visit the Arboretum at Penn State. Kate Reeder leads our tour.
Kate, tell us about the Arboretum at Penn State. I think a lot of people probably don't even know it's there and available for the public to explore.
Oh, I can understand that. Unless you go past it on Park Avenue or happen to see one of the ads for our annual pumpkin festival, you might not really know that we're there yet. But the H.O. Smith Botanic Gardens here in central Pennsylvania opened 11 years ago based on donations. So it's basically a gift from people who have the means, large and small, to the community. These gardens and then the larger arboretum, altogether there are 370 acres, which you probably would never know unless I told you or you went out of your way to find out. They're all available, free admission, open daily, even holidays, from dawn until dusk.
Obviously, there are lots of plants. Maybe you can explain if there are certain rooms or different gardens dedicated to different themes. And then also, I'm guessing that scattered throughout the garden, there are different types of works of art, maybe sculpture.
We don't have a lot of art sculpture as such in the gardens at this point, except in the children's garden. Of that 7 acres, approximately 1 acre is Childhood's Gate Children's Garden. And there are animal sculptures in there that were created to delight children and their families. And that garden's based on the geology and the flora and the fauna of central Pennsylvania. We have a limestone cave, you know, which is very familiar to people in this area. Of course, it's made with shotcrete, which is a kind of concrete, because we couldn't transplant a cave, but it does mimic, you know, the feel and the coolness, the stalagmites and the stalactites in the ceiling and the floor. And there's a little sand area, play area there. So it's geared to kids, and it's pretty exciting to go through it. It's one of the highlights, I think.
I'm a kid at heart. I'm pretty excited to see the animal sculptures. Who doesn't love animal sculptures?
In addition to the sculptures and a large discovery tree, supersized because kids love to explore. So everything leads to a story, and there are boulders that tell about the history of the earth. We are in the beginnings of an educational program where we'll have docents trained to take people through when things are safe to do. But the good part about the gardens is that you can go through on your own and explore.
Yeah, and you can be socially distanced, but it's still a good idea, I'm guessing, to wear a mask when you may not be able to socially distance from others.
Exactly. We just ask that people carry a mask with them. I mean, we have a lot of wide open spaces, and there are additional places in the gardens to explore. Like there's a subtropical and tropical room, as you called it, and there's a raised pool in our oasis garden with aquatic plants that many people take photos of because they're so beautiful. And they're, of course, blooming. We've had plenty of heat to enable the tropical plants to thrive. They have been very happy this summer.
Yeah, excellent. Kate, what is one of your favorite things there at the Penn State Arboretum?
One of my favorite parts of the gardens is the design of the gardens themselves. We have an overlook pavilion where you can look off into the distance towards the Bald Eagle Ridge. And then you can also turn and look across a 1.5 acre lawn towards a fountain at the far end, and beyond that you see the Penn State campus. And then you can also go into these different garden rooms where you have the rose and fragrance garden, the tropical plants, you have a children's garden, and you have an esplanade. There are different places you can explore, and you can take your time and come back. In fact, I encourage people to keep coming back, because as the season changes, the colors and the fruits will change as well. So you'll have something new that you can photograph each time you go.
Wow, Kate. And is it a place where people can maybe bring the kids, pack a lunch?
Yeah, we don't mind small picnics. You know, we're just people, like 4 or 5 people, a little family has something like that. They want to sit down on the lawn and share. That's fine. If you have a large gathering, there are limits as to how large a group could be. And Penn State has its own guidelines for group gatherings. Because of the pandemic, we have to get special permission.
Great. It sounds like a fun destination where people can enjoy. It's not too far from home. Is there a place we can go online before we make the drive there to the Arboretum?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, a lot more information. It's arboretum.psu.edu.
That's Kate Reeder, Event and Marketing Coordinator for the Arboretum at Penn State in State College, Pennsylvania. I'm Tracy Lynn with Family Life News. Today, we're spotlighting a few of our 2020 staycation destinations. Next, we take you to a unique body of water, the Erie Canal.
Shane Mahar with the New York State Canal Corporation shares a bit of history for the famous waterway, as well as some of the ways you can now enjoy the sights, activities, and welcoming small towns between Buffalo and Rochester.
The New York State Canal Corporation manages and owns the New York State Canal System, which encompasses four canals, 524 miles of waterway, the historic and original Erie Canal, the Champlain Canal, the Oswego Canal, and the Cayuga-Seneca Canal.
Wow. We know that the famous waterway, the Erie Canal, connecting regions of New York State, has a long history. Please tell us some of the details.
Sure. So the original Erie Canal opened in 1825 and connected the Hudson River to the Great Lakes and opened up not only New York State for a western expansion, but the entire country. Cargo and goods and people could easily move along the canal once it was constructed between 1817 and 1825.
Shane, what sort of impact did the Erie Canal have on the Empire State's economy?
So it made New York the Empire State. It opened up New York for commercial traffic, for commercial cargo, allowing folks and companies to move goods between point A and point B, and really opened up the interior of New York and really the country for that Western expansion of not only people and products, but businesses, et cetera. And New York City is the financial capital it is today of the world because of the Erie Canal and its connection to the waterways.
Shane, what was the first segment of the Erie Canal to be completed?
Ground was broken on July 4th, 1817 in Rome, New York. The canal was dug in sections across the state and was officially completed and opened on October 26, 1825, when then-Governor DeWitt Clinton boarded the packet boat, the Seneca Chief, in Buffalo, carrying a cask of Lake Erie water. The governor and his entourage boarded the boat, and they traveled east on the Erie Canal to Albany and then down the Hudson River to New York City in early November, where the governor poured the cask of Lake Erie water into the Hudson River and Atlantic Ocean there.
Wow, can you imagine being there on that day?
I know, very cool.
The Erie Canal system now spans over 500 miles, but today you and I are focusing on the segment from Buffalo to Rochester. What highlights can visitors expect along the trail or the waterway?
So the current canal system that encompasses all four canals is 524 miles of waterway, the Erie Canal being the longest of the four canals that we currently operate, connecting Waterford to Lockport and Buffalo. And really, the stretch between Rochester and Buffalo is really the sweet spot along the canal system. Beautiful landscapes, great small towns, where the canal really follows the original hand-dug, land-cut path. That part of the canal is all man-made. Much of it is an elevated embankment where the canal is actually raised up from the landscape. So in some spots, someone could be looking out their second-story window and a boat could be going by on the canal at that same level. Great small towns in upstate New York, lots of economic activity there, lots of opportunity for boating, for fishing, for kayaking. Small towns where each of those communities have adopted the canal and really rolled out the welcome mat for visitors and tourists to come see their individual towns in the greater canal region. There's great mom and pop stores and shops, ice cream places, bike shops, kayak rental places, etc., where folks could really come and explore the great upstate New York outdoors without traveling too far from home.
Wow. And is there anything that stands out specifically, like say if we go to Rochester?
Yeah. So this summer in the Rochester region, the Canal Corporation is working in partnership with the Genesee Waterway Center, where the Erie Canal and the Genesee River cross in the city of Rochester. And we are sponsoring a program to offer folks free access to kayaks and bicycles. So folks can sign up through the Genesee Waterway Center to kayak along the Erie Canal, and they would go through Lock 32 to experience how a lock operates and the elevation change between the canal right there. And they could also pick up a bike for free and go cycling on the Empire State Trail. So that program is running through Labor Day, and folks can either go to our website to find the link at canals.ny.gov, or go directly to the Genesee Waterway Center and sign up for that availability.
Some fun adventures. You're getting that homey feel and you get to do some activities, biking or kayaking. Did you mention that there was a spot or something special going on in Buffalo as well this summer?
So also the staycations campaign in the Buffalo area, working with local vendors who already rent kayaks and bicycles for the Empire State Trail. That's mostly in the Tonawanda area, where the Erie Canal joins the Niagara River. And all of that information is also available on our website, canals.ny.gov.
Wow, thank you. That's so cool. And is there anything else that you would like guests to know along the Erie Canal?
The Erie Canal, specifically in Western New York, it's such a treasure. It's beautiful landscapes. It's bucolic neighborhoods. It's great little downtowns. A colleague of mine often says that 80% of upstate New York's population lives within 20 miles of the Erie Canal. There's great opportunities for people to enjoy this beautiful amenity in their backyard. Come cycle on the Empire State Trail. Come kayak. Come rent a boat. Come experience a lock or a lift bridge. And really come visit the local downtowns. Obviously, this year, we encourage everyone to practice safe social distancing and wear a mask when that's not possible, just out of the abundance of caution and to ensure that everyone, if traveling local or maybe a little bit of a distance, remains safe this year.
That's Shane Mahar with the New York State Canal Corporation, helping us explore the locks, docks, and quaint towns along the western stretch of the Erie Canal between Buffalo and Rochester, New York. If you'd like to learn more about any of these destinations, you can find a list at fln.org/podcasts. May you and your loved ones safely enjoy time together today. Thanks for coming along on this special holiday edition of the Noon Report on Family Life.